It is just about half past, 28 minutes after the hour on a therapeutic Thursday. Pastor Robbie Pruitt joins us from Ashburn, Virginia. He's an Anglican priest, and he is a near genius. I say near genius.
Far from
when,
it.
When it comes to biblical context. He's also the executive director of Preserving Bible Times, and you'll need to know about that ministry. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but... But Robbie, you got your collar on and everything. You were where were you?
I was at it was a community breakfast, Loudoun County Community Prayer Breakfast, where the community gathers, a lot of ministry leaders and priests and pastors and business leaders, and we come together, we pray together. And
it's like the National Prayer Breakfast, but on a smaller scale, I guess.
Yeah, it's actually at a country club. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful, you know, time to get together, a beautiful place, and they feed us a full breakfast. So it's a wonderful time to gather and hear people's testimony. Heard a very powerful testimony from a married couple about how their life turn from the unexpected kind of downward spiral to resurrection, which is a little bit about what we're talking about today with Lazarus. And I just want to thank you for having me on. It's a joy to be with you and Sharon today.
Yeah, it's good to have you too. And yeah, we missed Sharon on Tuesday, technical difficulties, but she managed to wind her way through the technical morass and clicked on here. So that's a good thing. Robbie's just had a big breakfast, so he's probably going to go take a nap right after we're done. So we'll talk fast here.
Hopefully not while we're talking, you know.
Lazarus, that's quite a story, and it really gets us toward to the brink of Passion Week. This was just before Passion Week. It was winter. John 10 tells us that it was winter time, and Jesus went down to the Jordan. Now he was in Jerusalem for feast day, and he was contending with the Jews who wanted to know, just tell us plain out if you're the Messiah. And he said, I did. You don't believe me. And he wound up going down toward Jericho and then probably someplace slightly north of Jericho, because that was the winter, that was Palm Springs of Israel. Herod had a big palace down there. He would go there during the winter months. And Jesus, being an itinerant rabbi, he didn't have a house to stay in. The sunshine and warmth would have been greatly appealing to him. I remember, now I asked you earlier if you knew precisely where he was, because Martha and Mary sent a messenger to him to tell him about Lazarus, and it didn't say Jericho. They didn't identify the specific location, but I remember talking with Doug Greenwald on the air once, and he said he believed it was in Perea, which I just looked up, and it is north of Jericho. It's east of the Jordan River, so the location is pretty close. But it also is part of Decapolis, which shocked me a little bit. So we don't know precisely where he was, but it was about a two-day walk from Jerusalem, was it not?
Yeah, you're getting this from verse 40. You could probably do it in a day, actually. The issue is the ascent. I mean, you've got you're 1,400 feet below sea level at Jericho, and then you've got a 2,000-foot ascent. So you've got roughly 2,300 to 2,400 foot of ascent. So consider, we used to, when we backpacked, we considered an extra hour for every 1,000 foot of ascent. But then you've got to consider your miles per hour there too as you're traveling. Depends on how far north and east he was of Jericho, but it's not too far away. I mean, you could definitely ascend the Jericho Road from Jericho in a day's journey.
And you got to remember that all the travel was by foot back then. They didn't have taxi cabs. They didn't have Uber. They didn't have even horses for the most part.
Horses for sure, not Uber. For sure.
So that was a well-traveled road, though, because there was a lot of traffic between Jericho and Jerusalem. And, of course, from Jericho, as you mentioned, you are ascending at least 1,400 feet. It's an arduous walk. Takes a while. And oftentimes, there's a large group of pilgrims headed up that road that have come down from the diaspora up north of the Jordan River, down through the Jordan Rift, they call it. That's the river valley of Jordan. And then up that road to Jerusalem for example, Passover.
Right. And to be clear, I mean, we're talking 1,400 feet below sea level. So there's still, once you get above at sea level, you still got to climb another couple of thousand feet up to Jerusalem. So when you're there, you're at the lowest place on the planet. It's the lowest place you can be above, you know, keep your head above the waterline, below sea level, 1,400 feet. It's the lowest place on the planet. So when you visit there, literally, it's the lowest. It was the lowest point in my life, you know.
I'm just curious, having done a lot of road trips, especially like traveling to Phoenix, I go to Flagstaff, and there are various areas that talk about 6% grade and so forth. Is that particular road, do they have a lot of switchbacks, or is it pretty much straight up? And what kind of degree of, you know, the degree of grade, is this a fairly steep ascent, or is it just long because it winds around so much?
It's a great question. It's long, steep, and winding, and at least the road we drove on. Now they would be going on a road that would be by foot travel, basically a glorified trail in the time of Jesus. But the road follows that same route today. But it is long, it is winding, and it is very steep. I don't know the exact gradient. But
well, I'm sure it varies over the course, because there's probably some more level areas and up. But it was the Wadi Kilt. It's Q-I-L-T. Sometimes it's spelled with a K. You can look that up. There's some astounding pictures of, taken from the east, looking into the Wadi, which is a dry riverbed, and craggy mountains that you have to go up. That's a demanding walk.
And I'm thinking, just because you're going downhill, going the opposite direction, would not decrease the amount of time or energy, because sometimes going downhill is almost as arduous as going uphill.
Yeah, so they would have sent messengers to Jesus, it's the downhill slope, and then Jesus would have had to have ascend if he was in Perea, if he was in the Jericho region. So you've got the setting for Zacchaeus down in Jericho, you've got Herod the Great's palace there. You've got the setting for the parable of the Good Samaritan, and that's that road that ascends up to Jerusalem from Jericho. So
the setting, the time for this, it was, what, maybe a week or 2 weeks prior to the Passover week, which we all know about, and Palm Sunday and Jesus' teaching and the crucifixion and the resurrection. That was yet to come. And a lot of times, it's tempting to look at the raising of Lazarus as just another miracle. But this had a lot more power in it than maybe you're willing to understand. And I think we can explain that today. What made this so different from other miracles?
Well, again, you have to look at the uniqueness of the Gospel of John, because this account of the raising of Lazarus only occurs in John's Gospel. And so John has such unique content, not being a synoptic. The synoptic meaning same or similar being Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And here, when you get into John's gospel, you have a specific gospel for a specific reason to show you that Jesus is Lord. So John's one of the only gospel writers that will tell you in his 21 chapters why he writes his gospel. He says many other things did Jesus do that are not written in this book, but these were written down that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. So in other words, that Jesus is the Messiah, that he is the Son of God, that these are unique things that are written down. He acknowledges that there is, in a sense, you could paraphrase it and say, I know that there's a Matthew, I know there's a Mark, and I know there's a Luke, but these things are written. In other words, many other things that Jesus did, and I think John is actually citing something bigger than the other known gospel accounts. I think he's also citing many other teachings and miracles that Jesus did that weren't recorded. But John is curating a set of teachings and miracles, specifically seven signs and seven I am statements in John's gospel, of which we have a sign and an I am statement in John chapter 11 with Lazarus. I am the resurrection and the life, Jesus says. This is one of the I am statements. And then this sign or this miracle that he is indeed who he says he is, and this is the resurrection of Lazarus from the dead.
But this was like the straw that broke the camel's back. This started the crucifixion. I mean, it was probably all already in the minds of the Pharisees or the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem. They were already worried about Jesus. They knew who he was, but this may have been the singular event that tipped it over, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And we talked about another one last week. We talked about the pools of Siloam and the pools of Bethesda. Mm-hmm. So the Siloam pool and the Bethesda pool. At the Bethesda pool, when Jesus heals the man on the Sabbath day, tells him to pick up his mat and walk, you can hear in the response of the religious leaders that they set out in this moment to kill Jesus. That they have it in their mind to do this, and you have a similar echo about after the raising of Lazarus, that again, Caiaphas prophesies that this man is going to die to save many. He means it in an earthly sense. In other words, we're going to crucify this guy so that he doesn't cause an uprising with the people and cause Rome to come in and squash our people and squash our religion and shut us down.
Now, Caiaphas was the chief priest, so he was mm-hmm. top dog in the religious establishment in Jerusalem. I've often wondered if his statement that he would say it was better that one man die than we lose then we lose our cash cow, the Temple
right.
Incorporated. But I'm wondering if that wasn't in a sense prophetic.
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's prophetic in multiple ways. It's prophetic that we're going to kill him and save our system. Certainly, that's in a way transpiring. But it's also prophetic in that they're going to kill Jesus, enabling him to die, be dead for 3 days, on the third day rise again to defeat death once and for all, to resurrect and literally provide salvation for all people for all of time. And he doesn't know what he's saying. So we're beginning with the end in mind. It reminds me of Stephen Covey. We're dealing with chapter 11, but we've already jumped to the end of the account post-resurrection. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about where this thing lands. Where does this resurrection land? So we began with where Jesus is. We know that when he's approached, he says that Lazarus is not, they say Lazarus is dead. And he says, no, he's just sleeping. And they said, well, let's go wake him up.
Mm-hmm.
And then they
tell him,
logical
thought, yeah.
You're missing the boat here. He's dead. He's going to wait there 2 days.
Now, this was down in Perea or somewhere in that vicinity with his disciples, where he was basically in camp for the winter.
Yeah, and you need to get that context. The listener will need to go back to chapter 10, verse 40 for that particular context. So it says, and he went away again beyond the Jordan to the place where John was baptizing. So that's your cue. This is where Doug was saying it's most likely Perea north and east, where the baptismal site was for John. So that's your cue, and that's where you can say it's not Jericho, it's Perea. And it's from this verse of context in verse 40.
But the distance is a key to this whole story, because Martha and Mary wanted him there.
Absolutely. They send for him. And the issue's not just the distance. It's that he doesn't get on his way. You know, I tell this to my girls every morning when I'm trying to take them to school. You know, I tell them, I want to leave by 7:25 this morning, girls. And they're ready at the door at 7:25. But what I'm trying to tell them is them fumbling around at the door and not actually leaving the house and getting in the car is going to make us late. And this is a battle we face every single morning. You can't get to where you're going unless you leave where you are. And this is the issue. Not only does Jesus have at least a day's journey, but it takes time from the time Lazarus is sick to get the message a day's journey to Jesus, mm-hmm. that he's sick unto death, and then for Jesus to stay there 2 days. before he gets on his way a day's journey.
And in our culture, that would be considered more than rude.
Sure.
Because sure. Kind of in our household, it became standard that you build in extra time ahead so that you will be traveling by that point, mm-hmm. not just thinking about, well, I need to go, but to move on. And I had looked up some images on an internet search to see what that road was like, and it wasn't a straight ascent. It was up a while and down a while, and mm-hmm. but you've got to also wonder about the messengers that they send. Are these young people that are, you know, race runners? And as you say, how long did it take to get the message? So,
exactly.
But as believers, we also have that comprehension that Jesus already knew this.
Mm-hmm.
He could have left before the messenger ever got there.
Oh, yeah.
We but that see wasn't it. The purpose. That
that's
wasn't
a good
the
point.
Purpose.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, it's an absolutely wonderful point. And to your point about building in the extra time, the military says to be on time is to be late. To be early is to be on time. So, yeah, that expression, to be early is to be on time, to be on time is to be late. But Jesus isn't early, and he's not on time. He's late. He's late, late. He's late, late, late. He's 2 days late.
But you know, again, he's late from the human perspective.
Right.
But not according to God's timetable, because God's timetable is always perfect.
And there you are, Sharon. I mean, this is what we're going to find out is absolutely happening here. Jesus is controlling chronology for his purposes and benefit. And what it looks like is abandonment. It looks like Jesus is shaming his friends, humiliating his friends, and abandoning his friends. Doug Greenwald was quoting one of the psychologists that he liked a lot, and he called it the Bermuda Triangle of the soul: shame, humiliation, and abandonment. And this is what Mary and Martha are experiencing. But in actuality, Jesus is controlling the timeline, and he does it on purpose. Nothing Jesus does is by accident. So when we see in John chapter 11 that he was sick, that Lazarus is sick, and he's in Bethany, Lazarus of Bethany, the town where Mary and her sister Martha, we see them in Luke chapter 10, Mary and Martha. This is the two sisters, and Mary's sitting at Jesus's feet, and Martha's, you know, working, and says, don't you care that she, you know, this is these are these sisters, and this is unique to Luke's account. So we see these sisters again in another unique account in John chapter 11. So it was Mary that also anointed Jesus's feet with the fragrant oil, wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. And so they sent for Jesus, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. So Jesus loves Lazarus. They're close friends. And when Jesus hears this, he says, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God. Now, we've heard this before. We heard this in John chapter 9 about the blind man. Neither this man nor his parents sinned that this man was born blind, but that the glory of God might be fulfilled. So again, Jesus says the sickness is not going to lead in death, but so that God's glory might be fulfilled. And then he leaves him to die. He waits. He tarries the 2 days for Lazarus to die, which sounds like, wait a minute, I thought you said this sickness isn't going to end in death, and here's my dead brother. So this is how the narrative begins in John chapter 11.
So when they said he's been dead 3 days already, so that would be like the 2 days that Jesus gets the message and then the third day to travel to actually get there?
Well, it's four. Maybe a day to get the message to Jesus, 2 days for him to wait, and another day to travel. And then we know that it's actually 4 days. And we see this in verses 38. So okay. Jesus again is groaning. This is chapter 11, verse 38. Jesus again is groaning within himself. He came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." And Martha, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, "By this time, Lord, he stinks, for he has been dead 4 days."
Now that right. 4 days has great cultural significance. There's a reason. This is the reason why Jesus waited, correct? He wanted 4 days because, and I'll leave that up to you.
Well, Eli from Institute of Biblical Studies tells us that this is the belief that the nephesh or the spirit of the person. So it's in the Talmud. Mm-hmm. We read in the Jerusalem Talmud, for the first 3 days after the death, the soul floats above the body, thinking that it will return to the body. When the soul sees the body, that the appearance of the face has changed, it leaves the body and goes away. So this is chapter 16, verse 3 of Yevamot, and I'm butchering that, Yevamot. And it's a ancient literature of the Talmud.
So this was a Hebrew teaching. Not just a custom, but it derived from Hebrew written history.
So the Jews believed that this nephesh, the soul of the person, would hover over the body, and that there would still be hope of resurrection as long as the soul was hovering. So this could happen up to 3 days. So this idea that Jesus waits 2 days actually makes him a day later than hope extends. Mm-hmm. Let me say it that way. So he is waiting a day later. So hope runs out, and then a day passes. So Lazarus is dead. He's dead. He's good and dead. And there's no doubt about it, and all hope is lost.
Which gives even greater credence to the whole supernatural not appearance, but the whole supernatural aspect of the resurrection, because it is beyond what tradition said was even possible for a resurrection. So there's no way this could have happened apart from God.
Right. Exactly. And look at what Lazarus's name means, because that comes into play here as well. Lazarus' name means God, my God is my help. My God is my help. And you hear this in the sister's plea to Jesus. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But Martha says, but even now, whatever you ask God, he will hear you. And so again, he goes to the tomb, show me where you lay him. And then Mary comes to him. Lord, had you have been here, my brother would not have died. And there's the shortest verse in all of Scripture. Mm-hmm. Jesus wept. Now, many people hear that, and we men in the West, we don't cry. You know, real men don't cry. We don't shed tears. We don't show our weakness. But this is a combination. This is not just grief. It's certainly not helpless grief. You've heard it said, "Oh, Jesus wept," so we can count on the reality that he feels what we feel, that he empathizes with us, that his heart breaks for us. That's only part of what's going on. This weeping, this word for wept here, is as if a war horse is going into the battle. It's like he's breathing steam from his nostrils, and he rears up, and he lets out that cry of a horse. And that's what's being invoked here. Jesus is going to the tomb to call forth Lazarus from the dead. And you hear that he's dead. He's 4 days dead. And by now, the King James says he stinketh. Jesus prays so that the entire crowd can hear him. Lord, I pray, I know that you hear me. But I'm praying so that everyone here knows that you hear me.
Now, this crowd would have been friends and close relations of the family, but also professional mourners probably, and maybe others that knew Jesus was coming at that particular time, because he routinely had crowds of people follow him. So this was a probably a cultivated audience, because it was all so purposeful, so intentional. You know, just like Jesus never, you mentioned that everything was in, he never said, oops. I don't remember that from anywhere in the Bible, you know. So when you say like a war horse about to join the fray, this to him, I think, was the tipping point. And he knew he had accomplished the task he had of managing his death at a certain time in a specific way. This was the tipping point.
It's the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak, in regards to whether or not the religious leaders were going to let this go on. Mm. And now that they've got walking evidence of resurrection, Lazarus himself, they seek to kill not only Jesus, but they seek to kill Lazarus. So Jesus goes to the tomb. He asks them to remove the stone. They remove the stone. He calls forth with a loud voice, praying, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me, and I know that you always hear me. But because of the people who were standing by, even these professional mourners, certainly by now, the family, the crowds that know he's coming, this four-day anticipation of what will he do, but because of the people standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me." Hmm. Certainly, if he raises the dead, they'll know he's the Messiah, that the dead come out of the tombs. And he calls forth Lazarus and says, "Loose him and let him go." So Lazarus is risen. And now we go to the plot to kill Jesus, where Caiaphas has the prophecy, the twofold prophecy. It is better that one man die. Verse 49, and one of them, Caiaphas, being the high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you consider it, that it is expedient for us, it's beneficial for us, it's easy for us, if we go ahead and kill him, that this one man die, that he should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish." Now this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. Mm-hmm. He prophesies that Jesus' death would bring salvation and resurrection for all people. So what happens to Lazarus after he's resurrected? He dies again. Mm-hmm. And is resurrected again. So Lazarus is a man who dies twice and is resurrected twice. It's been said that if we're born once, we'll die twice. But if we're born twice, we only die once because of the resurrection. And Lazarus gets both. God bless him. He's born twice. He dies twice. He's resurrected twice. And why? To fulfill the prophecy, your brother's not going to die. Jesus keeps his promise to these sisters. I am the resurrection of life. And he asks an important question that we should ask ourselves, and is the point of this account. Do you believe this? Do you believe that Jesus is the resurrection and the life? This is the question we need to wrestle with ourselves. Do you believe death has the last word? Or do you believe that, like Jesus resurrected Lazarus, he will resurrect you in that last day? When you die, do you believe that you awaken to resurrection? This account brings about Jesus' own death, burial, and potential for resurrection. Without the death and without the tomb, you don't have the resurrection. And Jesus solidifies his own death through the resurrection of Lazarus.
It's more than a story. It's an historic event. And if you put that in the arena of I believe, this is a critical part of the story. You see the political chain of events, the chronological chain of this. It speaks to reality, real world experience. And John 11 is just a magnificent chapter, and the whole story is extremely dramatic. Robbie, did you know that? And this is extra biblical now, and it's what they call tradition. Traditionally, Lazarus and I think it was Mary, not Martha, went west and ended up running a kind of a mission in France, where they still have a chapel dedicated to them to this very day.
I didn't know that. That's great.
Yeah.
Hey, and if your folks want more disappointing delays in the glory of God from Preserving Bible Times, Doug Greenwald has a wonderful teaching on this.
Yeah, preservingbibletimes.org is their website. You can link to it right from our website at brokenroadradio.com. You'll find a wonderful resource for biblical context. Some of it is free. Some of it you pay for. You can buy if you want. But the things you buy, you get instantly. They're e-books and they're streaming video. And that library is growing day by day. So, Robbie, thanks so much. Appreciate what you brought to us today. And we'll look forward to next week.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim and Sharon. God bless.